Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into the natural disaster in Japan that has led to an unnatural disaster of already catastrophic proportions, which, since it is still ongoing, the full extent of the nuclear threat to Japan, its people and its environment is still unknown. One of the nation's top experts on nuclear power, David Glockbaum, who was formerly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and is now director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists, joins us. Then we will hear from Dan Hirsch, the president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, who studies issues of nuclear safety, waste disposal, proliferation, and disarmament. He will provide an additional perspective on the ongoing nuclear disaster, which some analysts are calling the worst in history, even more devastating than Chernobyl. Then finally, we will discuss the deepening tragedy in Libya, where, following the assessment of the Director of National Intelligence that Gaddafi will prevail, we will get an analysis of the Arab League's call for a no-fly zone and what is likely to follow. I'm speaking with David Glockbaum, one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power. He formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now serves as Director of the National Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Glockbaum.
Good morning, Ian. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. And the full extent of the disaster in Japan is yet to be known, obviously because it's an ongoing catastrophe. And I think, in fairness, the Japanese authorities have been less than forthcoming. Is that your feeling, that information is coming out in dribs and drabs?
It is coming out in dribs and drabs. I think it's also a reflection of the magnitude of the disaster they're facing. Most of the emergency response plans are structured to deal with one problem at one plant, and they're way beyond those assumptions and those realities. So they're struggling to keep up with a monumental disaster.
And at this point, what we know is that there is one partial meltdown at one of the plants, and then now the Japan nuclear, actually two of the reactors at one of the plants. And now we're told that the Japanese Nuclear Energy Agency has declared a state of emergency at a second nuclear power facility at Onagawa after excessive radiation levels. So let's start with Fukushima. Number one, first of all, there was what looked like a hydrogen explosion, and now we're told that there's a partial meltdown.
Yeah, the pictures and the stories are pretty clear that there was an explosion inside the reactor building, outside the containment building, but in the building that surrounds the containment building, that blew the metal siding off the upper floors. It's not clear what damage that explosive force did to the equipment, safety equipment inside that building, but it certainly didn't help it any. We're hearing this fuel damage on that first reactor. It's been described as a partial meltdown. It's difficult to tell the extent of the damage at this point. Even the 1979 accident at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania took almost 4 years until they were able to drop a camera down inside the reactor vessel to get a bigger, better picture of what the extent of the damage there. So there's been fuel damage. The extent is still to be determined.
And what do you think happened? At this point, apparently they're pumping in seawater and boric acid. But my understanding was that they had the tsunami warning. I don't know whether they shut the reactor down, but initially they lost power for the pump to circulate the coolant. Then the emergency power came on, but then went off again. And then it's been off since then. And then they've had to run on the second backup, which is batteries.
Yeah, that's the timeline that we're hearing, that the earthquake itself basically caused the primary source of power for the plant's equipment, the electrical grid, to be taken away. The plant's backup for that was on-site emergency diesel generators that can automatically start up and provide power, not for the entire plant, but for the essential equipment needed to cool the reactor and take care of other safety needs. The tsunami arrived approximately an hour later and disabled the emergency diesel generators. So now your primary power source and your backup power source are no longer available. The third backup, or Plan C, is a bank of batteries, very large batteries, that provide power just for the various barest bones set of emergency equipment needed to cool the reactor. And that third backup kicked in, was doing its role of cooling the reactor, but the batteries are not huge. They basically had enough capacity for about 8 hours of use. The assumption being that before the batteries get depleted, you've either recovered one of the emergency diesel generators or re-established the link with the electrical grid. Fortunately, this accident didn't follow that script, and the core on Unit 1 was not sufficiently cooled and apparently went into some level of fuel damage as a result.
And because of the buildup of hydrogen, and that led to an explosion that blew the roof off the containment.
Yeah, one of the byproducts of this type of fuel when it heats up is it tends to disassociate or cause, there's a chemical reaction between the metal tubes that contain the fuel pellets and the water, the steam that's flowing by them, and that produces hydrogen in pretty large quantities. It's not clear at the moment how the hydrogen got from the reactor vessel inside containment into the reactor building around that concrete structure, but it's pretty evident there was hydrogen did ignite in that building and cause some damage.
Again, I'm speaking with David Lochbaum, director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Formerly, he was with the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I think what apparently is more worrying, though, is at reactor number 3, because it burns a mixed oxide fuel, MOX, which contains considerable amount of plutonium. Now, what do we know about the partial meltdown there with reactor 3 at Fukushima?
Well, the latest we've heard is that the reactor core has been partially uncovered so that the water has either boiled away and uncovered. The last number we heard was about half, the top half of the reactor core has been uncovered by water. We're not hearing much data yet on the extent of fuel damage that situation produced. Reactor cores can be uncovered for a short period of time, and just the steam that's pouring off below it and running past the fuel can prevent a partial meltdown, but you don't have an infinite period of time to enjoy that situation, so you have to restore the water or face the consequences. We heard that they were able to hook up a fire pump to get water into the reactor vessel and also were injecting seawater, as had been done on Unit 1. I haven't heard anything definitive yet on whether those efforts were successful in preventing fuel damage.
But it is the fuel rods do are MOX, right, which has a lot more plutonium than the other.
Right. The Unit 3 reactor core did contain, the number I heard was it 8 fuel assemblies that had a mixture of both uranium and plutonium in them. One of the consequences or one of the prices you pay for that is that if there is a fuel damage, the potency or the size or the nastiness of the radioactive cloud that comes out of that damaged fuel is worse than the radioactive cloud from just a uranium fuel. So it tends to make the consequences of a reactor accident worse than they'd otherwise be.
And at this point, there's an estimated 170,000 people that have been evacuated from the area. We don't know what is happening with the other area that was just announced, that where there's a second nuclear emergency has been declared. That's in Onagawa. Do you have any information on what's happening at this second nuclear facility?
What we're hearing there is that it's similar to the casualty that the first two reactors suffered, in that there wasn't sufficient or adequate core cooling or cooling for the reactor core, and as a result, the challenge of it overheating. It seems to be occurring later than the first two, so I don't know. It's going down the same path, apparently, that the first two took. So I hope maybe the workers will be successful in diverting it before it gets to the same destination. That remains to be seen.
But the work is already at Fukushima. One would think that is a pretty hostile environment, isn't it, in terms of exposure to radiation? When you're in close there trying to cover the core or pump the seawater in, that does, obviously there's a lot, that requires manpower, right?
Yes, it does. Some of the workers had to go to places to make some alignments to make some of these things happen. And also, they did some venting in the recent past, and that takes workers going into places to make that happen. And the hydrogen explosion itself blew metal siding and across the site and also did some damage within the building itself. We heard at least one fatality on Unit 1 and some injuries over the past 2 days.
And in Chernobyl, of course, we know that a lot of the firemen and the workers that were literally racing across and shoveling boron onto the burning core, some of them died, and they were all exposed. So I guess we don't have any idea of the extent to which how much exposure radiation is coming out of those out of that, or how exposed that core is in Unit 1.
There have been accounts of high radiation levels in the Unit 1 control room and cesium and other radionuclides detected in the air outside the plant. From the published reports so far, it doesn't sound like the exposure or the amount of radioactivity is as bad as it occurred at Chernobyl, but the situation is still ongoing. It's far from a finish line, good, bad, or indifferent, so it doesn't look like it's that bad yet, but it's still on a path that it could approach or exceed it.
And then the Unit 3, right next door on the same site, that has the potential of spewing plutonium into the air, which is far infinitely more dangerous than the radioactive particles that might be escaping it from Unit 1. And then we have to add to that the other accident at the Onagawa, you say it's going down the same path. How far along that path, we don't know.
That's correct. Because they're on that path, there's still time for workers to reestablish cooling and keep it from that destination. We hope that they're successful in those efforts. Time will tell how successful or not their efforts have been.
And I guess this is where the rubber meets the road, right? In nuclear power, in terms of the potential for an accident, that if you get behind the curve, then it exponentially gets out of control. And in the case of Chernobyl, it was largely a man-made because they were fooling around with a backup system, they literally created that accident. I'm correct in that, Ryan.
Yeah, they were actually testing a safety system to make the plant even less vulnerable to accidents. Mm-hmm. That test went horribly awry, and the safety test actually turned into a safety disaster.
Right.
It wasn't self-inflicted wound of monumental proportions.
But in this case, a natural disaster has led to this unnatural disaster, and the backup systems were overwhelmed by this kind of chain reaction of the tsunami that put out, even though they'd shut it off, the tsunami took out the emergency backup diesel generators, and then now they're relying on batteries, and now they're relying on seawater. God knows what's happening to all the contaminated water, but that, I guess, is really where the big unknown is: the environmental damage and the damage to the inhabitants of the area.
Yeah, it's there's a lot that's remaining to be figured out on this one. But they still, even the use of seawater, if they're successful in cooling the reactor core, that safety net comes at a price, because seawater is very corrosive to metal, and the safety equipment and other devices inside the containment building really aren't designed for exposure to seawater and its corrosive effects. So, their first priority is to cool the reactor core. So, they're instructed to use seawater if nothing else is available. But that, in time, that seawater may start disabling some of the instrumentation and controls they're using to diagnose and react to situations in the containment, so they may have some problems. They already have some problems, but there's going to be many long days ahead for the people of Japan.
And just in the last few minutes, then, David Lochbaum, again, Director of Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists, formerly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. These are Westinghouse light water reactors, are they?
The Unit 1 and Unit 3 are actually General Electric.
General Electric, but they're basically...
I'm sorry.
Aren't they the scaled-up version of Rickover's original propulsion unit for the nuclear submarines? Is that the genesis of their design?
These are boiling water reactors, which were not really amenable for submarines that Rickover used, because boiling water reactors, as a submarine tilts upward, downward, and makes many of the other maneuvers underwater, the boiling water reactor isn't as conducive for that environment. So these are land-based reactors that were developed around the same time as the Rickover's engines, but they're a different design.
Well, that was the point I wanted to make, David, was that these are very early designs that I know at Los Alamos and other places they've developed much newer generations of nuclear reactors that have many more safety redundancy features built in. It just seems to me extraordinary that the oldest designs of civilian nuclear reactors are the ones that have proliferated around the world thanks to us, largely, right?
Yeah, we developed the technology. There are some other reactors around. The United Kingdom, for example, went to more gas-cooled reactors, and we went for light water reactors. All of ours are that way, and most of the reactors around the world kind of followed suit. But there are a few other designs around. But to be fair to the reactor designers or the age of the designers, being hit with an earthquake and then a fairly severe tsunami was just something that wasn't in the cards. Had either one of those occurred, Fukushima, I'm not sure we'd be talking about the plant today. But when you get the 1-2 punch of a very severe earthquake followed about an hour later by a fairly large tsunami, that's tough for any reactor to handle.
But not unprecedented in Japan, given its history.
No, it's something in hindsight, we probably should have anticipated and taken more steps to protect against. The related lesson that we ought to learn from this is that third set of power, the batteries, were only sized to last for 8 hours, and then once, if you didn't get things fixed before the clock ran out, you were pretty much left with very few options or no options. We shouldn't put the operators and the workers in that such thin conditions that, after 8 hours they're out of emergency equipment. That was a pretty tenuous assumption that's come up with tragic results here.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here and giving us an analysis of what's actually happening here, as much as we can tell. I thank you, David Lochbaum.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Ian.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with David Lochbaum, who's the director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and he was formerly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Dan Hirsch, president of the Committee to Bridge a Gap, a non-profit nuclear policy organization focusing on nuclear safety, waste disposal, proliferation, and disarmament. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Dan Hirsch, president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, a non-profit nuclear policy organization that focuses on issues of nuclear safety, waste disposal, proliferation, and disarmament. Mr. Hirsch lectured at UCLA from 1975 to 1983 and is the former director of the Adlai Stevenson Program on Nuclear Policy at the University of California in Santa Cruz. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Hirsch. I was just speaking then with David Lochbaum, who was formerly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and is now director of the Nuclear Safety Project, the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we're talking about these reactors. They're the number one at Fukushima is in partial meltdown. Number three is also apparently in partial meltdown with MOX fuel, which has a greater contains a lot more plutonium. And then there's also this other ongoing situation at another site, Onagawa, where apparently they're on the same path. I don't know how many reactors are involved in that one. Do you have any update on Onagawa?
Well, there was some report of some elevated radiation readings then a conflicting statement by the operators of that plant that they thought that was actually radioactivity that had been blown from towards them from the other reactors. We've had reports over the last several days initially of one reactor in trouble, then two, then 3, then 5, and then 6. So there may be something on the order of a half dozen reactors that have had their primary cooling systems failing. They're having various levels of difficulty. Some of them are having to vent the radioactive steam to try to keep the pressure from getting too high inside the reactor vessels. And then it looks like at least 2 of the reactors, significant evidence that there is a partial meltdown underway for those 2.
And what's the distance between Fukushima and Onagawa, given that that there was a suggestion that maybe the radiation that's been detected there has drifted across in the atmosphere?
I don't know the distance. It's just at least some miles. We just can't answer the question now whether there's trouble or if it's just the radioactivity from other reactors. But we have at least 6 reactors in trouble. If there's more than that, it's even worse.
And the fact that there is radiation in the air, we don't know the extent of how much Japan is being contaminated.
Well, here's the fundamental problem. These are boiling water reactors. That means that they aren't under pressure. The water inside the reactor core boils into steam. And with the loss of coolant and the loss of the pumps, the pressures have been building up inside several of these reactors. And the only thing they've been able to do is to intentionally vent that radioactive steam into the atmosphere. In a meltdown, you're worried about fuel melting and causing a breach of the containment. These are boiling water reactors that have very small containments. And so in order to avoid pressure in the reactor vessel building up too much and then pressure in the containment structure causing it to breach, they're intentionally releasing that radioactive material. We just don't know how much. They've had to declare international emergencies at Units 1 and 3 because of the elevated radiation levels that are being found. They're exceeding permissible levels. They aren't giving us the figures as to how much they're exceeding them by. But it's clear that there has been some melting of fuel. When fuel melts, some of the most dangerous of the radioactive materials, such as iodine-131, cesium-137, strontium-90, become gaseous. They are volatile at these temperatures, and so they are, when they're intentionally venting that steam, they are venting that radioactive material as well.
And Unit 1 at Fukushima doesn't have a roof because the hydrogen explosion blew it off.
It's extraordinary. When nuclear fuel gets uncovered, when the water level drops below the fuel, and fuel overheats and melts, there is a cladding on the fuel made out of zirconium. Zirconium reacts with the steam and releases hydrogen. And that hydrogen leaked out of the reactor vessel into the containment structure somehow, or was pumped out, and then apparently leaked out of the containment, which is worrisome because it suggests the containment is not intact. It leaked into the reactor building, and in the presence of air, exploded and blew the top off of that reactor building. Among the uncertainties right now is that the spent fuel pools in boiling water reactors are inside those reactor buildings, elevated fairly high up. And what no one has so far been giving us information about is the condition of the spent fuel pools. These are pools that have several cores worth of highly irradiated nuclear fuel in them, and they also have to be kept cool. So the fact that there was an explosion in the reactor building sufficient to blow the top off raises concerns about the condition of the spent fuel pools.
And if there's a breach in the pool and then and the water leaks out, spent fuel then becomes emits radiation.
Yeah, this is the very troubling part about nuclear power. It operates by essentially being a controlled nuclear bomb. It can't explode like a nuclear bomb, but it's controlled fission. So when uranium splits apart, it splits apart into these very, very toxic materials like strontium and cesium and iodine that I mentioned, and they are radioactive. That means both that they give off radiation, which can cause cancer, but also they give off a huge amount of heat. That's what we use to boil the water, to produce the steam, to produce the electricity. But that heat, you need to be able to keep extracting from the fuel so that the fuel stays solid. As long as the fuel is solid, you get very little radiation release, but if it becomes melted, the radioactivity is released into the environment. And that's true also for the spent fuel. The fuel has been taken out of the reactor after having been used and then put into the storage pools. And in some circumstances, if you lose the coolant in the spent fuel pool, the zirconium cladding can catch fire. You can have a nuclear fire involving several nuclear cores worth of material, which is just an extraordinary nightmare. But we have enough of a nightmare. We have six reactors in trouble out there, and that is beyond what anybody had ever been able to conceive of. As bad as we always thought a single event could be, they now have apparently close to, perhaps half a dozen.
And along with France, Japan was considered one of the, it has a tremendous reliance on its nuclear portfolio for generation, and I suppose in many ways it was kind of a poster child along with France for nuclear safety. Clearly that is, as I mentioned with our previous guest, you know, he was saying, well, you know, this is pretty unforeseen that you have a tsunami, an earthquake, then a tsunami. But this is surely in a country that's had those events before, albeit this one being an extreme one. So
I think that's all very true. I mean, let's be clear. The event that has occurred at these reactors at Daini and Daiichi is what's basically called in the industry a station blackout, where you lose the off-site power, and you then have to use your backup diesel generators to provide electricity to run the pumps. The general audience may not understand this immediately, but because it's counterintuitive, but a reactor which produces electricity needs electricity to run its pumps to keep the fuel from melting. So it needs to have off-site electric power coming in. And in the case of the earthquake, the earthquake brought those that power down. There was no off-site power, so they had to rely on the backup diesels. And those of us in the community that have been critical of nuclear power have always warned that there could be events where you lose the off-site power and the diesels fail. And the nuclear industry and, in our country, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission always said that was simply non-credible, their favorite phrase. It couldn't happen. What's happened now to half a dozen reactors in Japan. And even had the tsunami not come in and damaged the diesels about an hour after the earthquake, diesels aren't able to run for very long before they overheat. And that apparently, by the way, is what seems to have happened at one of the reactors where the diesels weren't initially damaged but ran for 2 days and then failed. So this prospect of losing both your primary electricity and your backup and then not being able to cool the core is something that those of us who have been critics have always raised. Having come from an earthquake and a tsunami, you know, that's a different matter. One can never predict precisely the initiating event. But to rely on a technology where you have 1,000 times long-lived radioactivity of the Hiroshima bomb inside each reactor and multiples of that inside each spent fuel pool, and where you have to keep it cool to prevent that from getting released to the environment, and where the only way you can do that is to have pumps work and electricity to those pumps continue, it's just a recipe for disaster, and that's what we're currently facing.
And, of course, Dan Hirsch, these issues were raised with Diablo Canyon, and which is on an earthquake fault, and, frankly, all of California is basically an earthquake fault, right?
Well, you remember David Brower's, famous environmentalist, great definition of nuclear power was that nuclear power is a complex technological device for locating earthquake faults in California. Because it seems like every time we build a reactor, we then discover an earthquake fault there. Diablo is very close to the Hosgri fault. There is evidence now of an additional offshore fault that may intersect the Hosgri, producing quakes that would be of greater ground acceleration than the plant was designed for. San Onofre similarly has faults nearby and some new evidence of additional faults that had not been initially recognized. We are earthquake country, and placing.
But also on the, they're on the beach. No phrase, right on the beach. They're right next to a potential tsunami.
Well, that's additional difficulty. Both San Onofre and Diablo are on the ocean because they need large amounts of cooling water, and you can have a tsunami that is nowhere near as severe as what we saw in Japan, and still damages the intakes. For both San Onofre and Diablo, they need to take in water from the ocean. Those intakes can be damaged, and you won't have the water to be able to cool the reactor. So it's a bottle filled with a huge amount of radioactivity, and you have to make sure nothing ever happens to cause that bottle to break. And it seems that that's not possible in the long term.
And you recall Dan Hirsch from the Chernobyl meltdown, that it was first detected, the radiation was first detected in Sweden. do we have any idea of the potential of radiation drift? I know, obviously, Japan is its environment, it's its people, and, you know, its long-term agricultural prospects, et cetera, are... We just don't know the extent to the dangers that that faces. But any indication of where the radiation, if it continues, might drift to?
Well, nuclear power risks are global, as we saw in Chernobyl. As you we point out, the doses, the radiation was first detected in Scandinavia. The plume then blew back towards Eastern Europe and then back to Western Europe and dosed much of Europe. In this case, we hope that there will be no significant release, and if there is one, that it, in fact, will blow out to sea primarily rather than over the Japanese landmass. But in any case, the prevailing winds globally are from west to east. So the if there were a plume from Japan, it would head towards the United States. It would take about 4 days to reach Alaska and an additional day or so to reach the west coast of the contiguous United States. During that time, there would be time for material to fall out of the ocean, and hopefully there would be rainstorms over the Pacific that would cause some of significant amount of that to rain out into the ocean, which of course is not good in itself because of the fish and so on. But the risk to the United States were several steps from having to be hugely concerned about that at the moment. At the present time, they do not have full meltdowns. They have containment structures that, although perhaps compromised, are at least still in place. And although they're intentionally venting radioactive material, that's different than a full meltdown where it all gets out. So let's pray that they can find a way to control this, even though they don't have power for pumps, and even though most of their emergency cooling systems have failed.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Hirsch, president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap. So, for example, Joe Cercioni was on ABC's program this morning and was saying that this is the worst disaster in history, worse than Chernobyl. You wouldn't go that far.
Ask me in a day or two. Right now, it is a massively... It has the potential to be worse than Chernobyl. Has the potential to be 10% or 5% of Chernobyl. We are not yet at the stage where that has developed. Chernobyl was a reactor that had an explosion followed by a fire. It was built out of graphite, and so the graphite burns, and the fire lofted into the atmosphere large amounts of particulate material. This would not be a fire. It would be a classical melt. If they can keep the containments largely intact, then they can control the release of some so they're not releasing everything. But we've got seawater now in those cores, and maybe the seawater can keep the cores cool enough so that the melting doesn't proceed beyond what we've already had as melted. We just don't know yet. I have to say that Chernobyl was so horrible, 100,000 to perhaps a million cancers worldwide produced by it, that even if this is less than Chernobyl, it could still be quite serious. And I want to remind you that it's not just one reactor involved now. They've got two that they think have melting going on and at least two more that are in serious condition, if not four more. So it's, in that sense, it's worse than anything we've ever experienced. We've never had an accident involving more than one reactor at a time.
And just in closing then, Dan Hirsch, what's your sense about... the very designs of these reactors, because this is apparently a GE design, and it goes back to the same era as the Westinghouse design, which comes out of the nuclear propulsion design of Rickover, Admiral Rickover's, and I'm just astounded that this is what technology that goes back to the 50s.
Let's be clear. The Diablo Canyon and San Onofre reactors are pretty old as well, and they also are trying to get their licenses extended to be able to run 60 years. It's not so much that these are old designs and that newer ones are much safer. I think that's the fundamental problem with nuclear power. This is a dangerous technology that we as a species are simply incapable of controlling. It proliferates nuclear weapons. It creates waste that's toxic for half a million years at Paris targets, and they are, as we are now seeing again, reminded again, they are very action-prone. So it's not like this old GE design, which is problematic, is somehow horrible and the others are great. The technology itself simply makes no sense. You would not have called me to have this conversation if the earthquake and tsunami had damaged a large array of solar photovoltaic cells or windmills in Japan. End of story.
Right. Well,
there would be no risk.
And, of course, it's worth reminding our audience, Dan Hirsch, that Admiral Rickover himself felt that nuclear power, if it was to happen, should have been controlled by the military, that he didn't even think it was so dangerous that civilians weren't sufficiently disciplined.
Well, that I understand as a military person that he was, that he would have that view. My own view is that we need a different species than human beings to run these things, because I just don't think we're capable enough. We cut corners, we save money, we have regulatory institutions that are captured so that the regulations are weakened, and that always ends up coming back to bite us. So I think the fundamental thing is we should be hoping and praying that this is brought under control in Japan and that the damage is kept limited. At the same time, we have got to finally learn our lesson. After Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and now these Japanese reactors melting, we have to turn away from this dangerous technology. And I am struck by the fact that a few months ago, President Obama announced that offshore deep water drilling was safe, and then we had the BP disaster. A few weeks ago, in his State of the Union speech, he said that nuclear power is safe and clean, and now we have the Japanese disaster. I hope that President Obama doesn't say that either you or I are going to live a long time, because who knows what will happen to us the next day. Not intending to be humorous about it, but the bottom line is we as a country are currently proposing $60 billion of taxpayer subsidies to build new nuclear power. And this has got to be a wake-up call that we have got to turn our backs on this dangerous technology and move to something that is safe and clean and sustainable and doesn't proliferate nuclear weapons. It's a terrible tragedy, but at some point human beings, we don't even have a right to avoid the damage to us if we don't learn from experience.
Sure.
And it wasn't just once, Three Mile Island, or twice, Chernobyl. Now it's three times. What does it take for us to learn?
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dan Hirsch.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Hirsch, President of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, a nonprofit nuclear policy organization that focuses on issues of nuclear safety, waste disposal, proliferation, and disarmament. Mr. Hirsch lectured at UCLA from 75 to 83 and is the former director of the Adlai Stevenson Program on Nuclear Policy at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the possibility that Gaddafi will prevail in Libya. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Welcome back to Background Briefing. And we are now going to change the subject somewhat, talk about another ongoing disaster that could get worse if according to the Director of National Intelligence, Muammar Gaddafi and his clan and his military assets that he controls will prevail. That was the judgment of the Director of National Intelligence, General Clapper, just on Friday. I'm joined here by Dirk van der Valle, who is the professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He's the author of A History of Modern Libya and Libya Since Independence, Oil and State Building. And also joining him is Ali Abdellatif Ahmida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Let me begin with you, Dirk van der Valle. I guess the prospect of Gaddafi winning and the freedom fighters, or the rebels, as I think they're rather misnamed as, clearly they've lost the oil port of Brega, and there's a possibility that Gaddafi could continue, as his son has promised, to drive all of the rebels back into the east, and that would, of course, create a massive refugee problem for Egypt. Let's go through that scenario. Do you think it's going to happen, and two, the idea of this guy winning and thumbing his nose at the world is pretty unpalatable, isn't it?
Well, I think the first issue, of course, is indeed, as you mentioned, the kind of changing dynamic that we've seen over the last few days. Initially, we had an insurgency, and that insurgency was really quite badly organized by nature, almost. And over the last few days, as indeed you said, the Gaddafi forces have managed to turn it back and to go eastward, so to speak. Now, in a sense, we've started to see an international reaction to it that was really absent also, and that, I think, will also play a very important role in what happens in the days and the week ahead. And that is the Arab League, for the first time, has really weighed in. And my understanding is that, in a sense, the approbation of the Arab League here was necessary for other actors, particularly the Europeans, but also the United States, for weighing in on this. And so we've seen Secretary Gates, for example, very reluctant to think about a no-fly zone. But my impression is that the hand of the United States, and particularly as the Arab League now has weighed in, but perhaps also the African Union, which is meeting in the next few days, and then, of course, ultimately, perhaps the United Nations, where China and Russia have been traditionally opposed to this, but their position, I think, is weakening a little bit as a result of what the Arab League has done. It could very well be that we see a number of initiatives that, first of all, perhaps would include a partly no-fly zone. But beyond that, I think it would create a kind of a permissive environment that several countries will then use to, if not officially, at least in unofficially, get some weapons into the hands of the rebels, primarily coming in through Egypt, I would think.
And let me turn to Ali Abdelatif Hamida. Just following on from Kirk van der Velde, is it also possible that not just weapons, which I believe are already flowing in, is it possible that once this no-fly zone, and if presumably Russia and China can be shamed into going along with the rest of the world, and clearly the Arab League weighing in helps in that direction, what about the possibility of the British? I believe the British and the Italians have some intelligence resources there. I don't think the U.S. does, but Egypt, for example, is there any possibility of not just helping arm the rebels, because that may have consequences later? What about the possibility of some kind of covert intervention with maybe Egyptian special forces or somebody to take out this family of criminals?
Well, what we have now is a really imbalanced in terms of power. The conflict now is going on. In one sense, the Gaddafi's regime lost all kind of moral standing and legitimacy in the eyes of many, many Libyans. And also condemnation in the Arab world and also worldwide after its disastrous, brutal shooting on the protesters in the eastern region, and also after that, the western region. So in that sense, that's one side of the conflict. But at the same time, the rebels, as Derek mentioned, they are really they don't have arms. They have volunteers. There are so many officers who defected to the side of the uprising, but they still are ill-equipped, ill-trained to face an army or the security brigades that Gaddafi is using right now. Now this. It's really, I think this is how the scene seems to me right now. At the same time, the United States has been, while condemning the shooting and the brutal repression, and called for Gaddafi to step down. In reality, I think there is a sense of realism, which trying to calculate what will happen if we intervene. And keep in mind that the United States and the Western government allowed the Gaddafi regime to be rehabilitated, but nobody paid attention to the internal situation. So I think these our forces are trying to fight over the future, struggle over the future of the countries, stick to Gaddafi or change the regime and side with the people. What I would see is very, very important right now is the Arab League took a decisive move for their, not necessarily for democratic, you know, reasons, but for their own calculation. But it's very important to keep that in mind. What's needed now is aid, maybe to consult with the council in the Libyan National Council in Benghazi about arms if needed. And also maybe the unthinkable. At the same time, I think negotiating with the Gaddafi regime to maybe to have resolution, perhaps we didn't think about that earlier, to maybe step down, go into exile, or some sort of negotiations if that's, you know, to resolve the stalemate, you know, I think that might be really a worthwhile trying. But right now, I don't think the Gaddafi regime, as we know it, and the leadership is gonna, you know, just say we're gonna stop now. They think that they could weather this storm, repress the rest of the country as they did in the past, and they look at other examples maybe that happened in Libyan past also, or maybe in the case of a country like Syria or other places.
Well, let me turn to Kurt Vandevelde, who's written a piece in Foreign Policy, How Not to Intervene in Libya. Your main points are you cannot divide and conquer, don't fall into Gaddafi's trap, take it slow, human rights matter, and so does oil. My fear, Dirk, is that Gaddafi actually has a lot more military power than he's even used so far, and that he's about to unleash that. So do you think that there's going to be more reverses to the freedom fighters in the short run?
I think so. I, you know, the momentum at this particular point in time is certainly on Gaddafi's side. But again, that doesn't mean that in the long run it necessarily will be, particularly if we see some actions taken like a no-fly zone. Again, the no-fly zone, in a sense, is not that terribly important by itself, because the real damage against the rebels is being done with, you know, hardware on the ground, the tanks, and so on. But I think the move by the Arab League really, in a sense, opens up a kind of what I would call a permissive environment for regime, for governments in the region, particularly, to kind of join in and more openly face the Gaddafi government. So, in that piece in Foreign Policy, I was extremely skeptical of open military intervention, particularly by the United States, both in light of the kind of exposure we already have in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also because it really plays very clearly into the narrative that Gaddafi has always used, you know, that the West will come and occupy the country for its resources. So I think the response, and I think in the end, some kind of military response is going to be unavoidable, whether it's kind of open official or whether it's through all kinds of deliveries and training of special forces, by special forces, and so on, from a number of Arab countries. But I would not be surprised, for example, to see one of the Arab countries at one point, particularly Egypt, of course, is the important player here, to really step up and take a more open position than what we've seen so far. Keeping in mind, of course, that Egypt has its own turmoil, but if you look at the kind of weapons that Egypt now has, that weapons are, by the way, delivered and have been given or sold to them under United States military packages, that those are precisely the kind of weapons that could be used to quell, to stop the Gaddafi regime. And so I do see changes happening, even though the immediate advantage, I think, still belongs to the Gaddafi side.
And Ali Abdelatif Ahmida, you mentioned the possibility of some negotiated settlement. Now, apparently, I don't know whether this offer is still on the table. I think Chavez in Venezuela and Ortega in Nicaragua are both apparently admirers of Colonel Gaddafi and would be willing to extend their hospitality to him. What's your sense of what his price of his exit would be? I imagine he's got billions and billions stored abroad.
Well, I think right now he feels like he could crush the uprising. So I don't know if he's going to negotiate now. But he knows he's been also a very, very shrewd tactician when it comes to security. So I believe that this might be some option that worth pursuing. However, there is another issue that we haven't talked about. It's not just training the uprisings army and the Council of Benghazi and under the leadership of the defected officers. The defense minister now is general by the name of Omar al-Hariri, who was original member of the Free Officers Union's organization that toppled the monarchy. But I think also important that there will be the international community will rein on and the United States particularly to rein on the North African countries, especially Algeria, and also the African countries that might send mercenaries or supporters to Gaddafi. Especially, we know Gaddafi has a lot of capital, social capital, due to his really long support for the African Union. As a matter of fact, whether we like it or not, he was behind the African Union in many ways. So he has a lot of support outside. That worries me quite a bit, because it means that in addition to the cash he has, the security brigades that he still has, he has also the ability to buy more mercenaries to his side.
And just in closing, Dirk van der Velde, do you think, given that there thousands have been killed so far, probably, and more will be killed if Gaddafi retakes the east, what kind of threshold are we talking about here in terms of a kind of sitting back and watching another Rwanda unfold?
Well, quite obviously, no matter which way this goes, whether, Gaddafi, on the one hand, reoccupies the east, which would, I think, be very, very bloody and would lead to all kinds of settlement, of course. But I think we should even think much further down the road, assuming that Gaddafi, for example, gets overthrown. Then this kind of state that he has created over the last 40 years, a very peculiar state in which no opposition or anything was allowed, in which people willy-nilly had to cooperate with the regime. All of this, I think, particularly if the regime were to go, will lead to what I would think would be a lot of settling of scores among people who have either worked for Gaddafi or against Gaddafi. And I think if there's one thing that the United States, particularly and the international community, perhaps should already be thinking about, particularly in the case of Gaddafi.
We've run out of time here, but I thank both of you for joining us, Ali Abdullah Atif and Kurt van der Velde. Sorry we've run out of time. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producer, Spencer Downing, and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog there, so go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You can comment there, and I'd love to hear from you. And I'll be back again tomorrow with Background Briefing. Bye for now.